You have guns. Other people around that corner have guns. I don't want any of you to get killed. There's been enough of that today, hasn't there? Tim, do you enjoy killing people?
Why?
No, of course not. Who does?
Well, some do, Bello told him,
deciding to build up his ego a little.
We call them sociopathic personalities.
But you're not one of them.
You're a soldier.
You fight for something you believe in.
So do the people back there.
Bello waved to where the rainbow people were.
They respect you, and I hope you respect them.
Soldiers don't murder people. Criminals do that, and a soldier isn't a criminal. In addition to being true, this was an important thought to communicate to his interlocutor. All the more so because a terrorist was also a romantic, and to be considered a common criminal was psychologically very wounding to them. He'd just built up their self-images in order to steer them away from something he didn't want them to do. They were soldiers, not criminals, and they had to act like soldiers, not criminals.
Dr. Bello, a voice called from around the corner.
Phone call, sir.
Tim, can I go get it?
Always ask permission to do something. Give them the illusion of being in command of the situation.
Yeah.
O'Neill waved him away. Bello walked back to where the soldiers were. He saw John Clark standing there. Together they walked 50 feet into another part of the hospital.
Thanks for getting my wife and little girl out, Paul.
Bello shrugged.
It was mainly luck.
He's a little overwhelmed by all this, and he's not thinking very well.
They want a bus.
You told me before, Clark reminded him.
Do we give it to him?
We won't have to do that. I'm in a poker game, John, and I'm holding a straight flush. Unless something screws up really bad, we have this one under control.
Noonan's outside, and he has a mic on the window.
I listened in on the last part.
Pretty good, Doctor.
Thanks.
Bello rubbed his face.
The tension was real for him, but he could only show it here. In with Timothy, he had to be cool as ice, like a friendly and respected teacher.
What's the story on the other prisoners?
No change. The Grady guy is being operated on. It'll take a few hours, they say. The other one's unconscious still, and we don't have a name or ID on him anyway.
Grady's the leader?
We think so.
That's what the intel tells us.
So he can tell us a lot.
You want me there when he comes out of the O.R., Paul told Rainbow Six.
You need to finish up here first.
I know. I'm going back.
Clark patted him on the shoulder, and Bello walked back to see the terrorists.
Well? Timothy asked.
Well, they haven't decided on the bus yet.
Sorry,
Bello added in a downcast voice.
I thought I had them convinced, but they can't get their asses in gear.
You tell them that if they don't, we'll...
No, you won't, Tim.
You know that. I know that.
They know that.
Then why send the bus? O'Neill asked, close to losing control now.
Because I told them that you're serious, and they have to take your threat seriously.
If they don't believe you'll do it, they have to remember that you might. And if you do, then they look bad to their bosses.
Timothy shook his head at that convoluted logic, looking more puzzled than angry now.
Trust me, Paul Bello went on. I've done this before, and I know how it works. It's easier negotiating with soldiers like you than with those damned bureaucrats. People like you can make decisions.
People like that run away from doing it. They don't care much about getting people killed, but they do care about looking bad in the newspapers.
Then something good happened. Tim reached into his pocket and pulled out a cigarette. a sure sign of stress and an attempt to control it.
"Hazardous to your health, boy," Clark observed, looking at the TV picture Noonan had established. The assault plan was completely ready. Connolly had line charges set on the windows, both to open an entry path and to distract the terrorists. Vega, Tomlinson, and Bates from Team One would toss flashbangs at the same time and dart into the room to take the bad guys down with aimed fire. The only downside to that, as always, was that one of them could turn and hose the hostages as his last conscious act, or even by accident, which was just as lethal. From the sound of it, Bello was doing okay. If these subjects had any brains at all, they'd know it was time to call it a day. But John reminded himself that he'd never contemplated life in prison before, at least not this immediately, and he imagined it wasn't a fun thought. He now had a surfeit of soldierly talent at his disposal. The SAS guys who'd arrived had chopped to his operational command, though their own colonel had come as well to kibitz in the hospital's main lobby.
"Tough day for all of us, isn't it, Tim?" the psychiatrist asked.
"Could have been a better one," Timothy O'Neill agreed.
"You know how this one will end, don't you?" Bello offered. "Like a nice fly to a brook trout, wondering if he'd rise to it."
"Yes, doctor, I do." He paused.
"I haven't even fired my rifle today. I haven't killed anyone."
"Jimmy did," he went on, gesturing to the body on the floor. "But not any of us."
Bingo, Bello thought.
"That counts for something, Tim."
"As a matter of fact, it counts for a lot.
You know the war will be over soon.
They're going to make peace, finally. And when that happens, well, there's going to be an amnesty for most of the fighters."
"So you have some hope?"
"You all do," Paul told the other three, who were watching and listening, and wavering as their leader was. They had to know that all was lost. Surrounded, their leader captured, this could only end in one of two ways— with their deaths or their imprisonment. Escape was not a practical possibility, and they knew that the attempt to move their hostages to a bus would only expose them to certain death in a new and different way.
"Tim?"
"Yes."
He looked up from his smoke.
"If you set your weapons down on the floor, you have my word that you will not be hurt in any way."
"And go to prison?"
Defiance and anger in the reply.
"Timothy, you can get out of prison some day. You cannot get out of death. Please think about that."
"For God's sake, I'm a physician," Bello reminded him. "I don't like seeing people die."
Timothy O'Neill turned to look at his comrades. All eyes were downcast. Even the Barry twins showed no particular defiance.
"Guys, if you haven't hurt anyone today, then yes, you will go to prison. But someday you'll have a good chance to get out when the amnesty is promulgated. Otherwise, you die for nothing at all. Not for your country. They don't make heroes out of people who kill civilians," he reminded them once again.
"Keep repeating," Bello thought. "Keep drumming it in."
"Killing soldiers, yes, that's something soldiers do. But not murdering innocent people. You will die for nothing at all. Or you will live, and be free again some day. It's up to you guys. You have the guns. But there isn't going to be a bus. You will not escape, and you have 6 people you can kill, sure. But what does that get for you, except a trip to hell?"
"Call it a day, Timothy," he concluded, wondering if some Catholic nun in grade school had addressed him that way.
It wasn't quite that easy for Tim O'Neill. The idea of imprisonment in a cage with common criminals, having his family come to visit him there like an animal in a zoo, gave him chills. But he'd known that this was a possibility for years, and though he preferred the mental image of heroic death, a blazing gun in his hand firing at the enemies of his country, This American doctor had spoken the truth. There was no glory in murdering 6 English civilians. No songs would be written and sung about this exploit. No pints hoisted to his name in the pubs of Ulster. And what was left to him was inglorious death. Life, in prison or not, was preferable to that sort of death. Timothy Dennis O'Neill turned to look at his fellow PIRA soldiers and saw the same expressions that they saw on his face. Without a spoken agreement, they all nodded. O'Neill safed his rifle and set it on the floor. The others did the same. Bellow walked over to them to shake their hands. 6 to Vega. Move in now, Clark called, seeing the picture on the small black-and-white screen. Also Vega moved quickly around the corner, his MP10 up in his hands. There they were, standing with the doc. Tomlinson and Bates pushed them, not too roughly, against the wall. The former covered them, while the latter patted them down. Seconds later, 2 uniformed policemen came in with handcuffs, and, to the amazement of the soldiers, read them their legal rights. And, just that easily and quietly, this day's fighting was over. Chapter 29. Recovery. The day hadn't ended for Dr. Bellow. Without so much as a drink of water for his dry throat, he hopped into a green-painted British Army truck for the trip back to Hereford. It hadn't ended for those left behind, either.
"Hey, baby," Ding said.
He'd finally found his wife outside the hospital, surrounded by a ring of SAS troopers. Patsy ran the 10 steps to him and hugged her husband as tightly as her swollen abdomen allowed.
"You okay?"
She nodded, tears in her eyes.
"You?"
"I'm fine. It was a little exciting there for a while, and we have some people down, but everything's under control now.
One of them...
Somebody killed him, and... I know. He was pointing a weapon at you, and that's why he got himself killed." Chavez reminded himself that he owed Sergeant Tomlinson a beer for that bit of shooting. In fact, he owed him a lot more than that, but in the community of warriors, this was how such debts were paid. But for now, just holding Patsy in his arms was as far as his thinking went. Tears welled up in his eyes. Ding blinked them away. That wasn't part of his machismo self-image. He wondered what damage this day's events might have had on his wife. She was a healer, not a killer, and yet she'd seen traumatic death so close at hand. Those IRA bastards, he thought. They'd invaded his life and attacked non-combatants and killed some of his team members. Somebody had fed them information on how to do it. Somewhere there was an information leak. A bad one, and finding it would be their first priority.
"How's the little guy?" Chavez asked his wife. "Feels okay, Ding. Really, I'm okay," Patsy assured him.
"Okay, baby. I have to go do some things now. You're going home." He pointed to an SAS trooper and waved him over. "Take her back to the base, okay?"
"Yes, sir," the sergeant replied.
Together they walked her to the parking lot. Sandy Clark was there with John, also hugging and holding hands, and the smart move seemed to be to take them both to John's quarters. An officer from the SAS volunteered, as did a sergeant to ride shotgun, which in this case was not a rhetorical phrase. As usual, once the horse had escaped from the barn, the door would be locked and guarded. But that was a universal human tendency. And in another minute, both women were being driven off, a police escort with them as well.
"Where to, Mr. C?" Chavez asked.
"Our friends were taken to the base hospital. Paul is there already. He wants to interview Grady, the leader, when he comes out of surgery. I think we want to be there for that."
"Roger that, John. Let's get moving."
Popoff was most of the way back to London, listening to his car radio. Whoever was briefing the media knew and talked too much. Then he heard that the leader of the IRA raiders had been captured, and Dimitri's blood turned to ice. If they had Grady, then they had the man who knew who he was, knew his cover name, knew about the money transfer, knew too damned much. It wasn't time for panic, but it was damned sure time for action. Popoff checked his watch. The banks were still open. He lifted his cell phone and called Bern. In a minute, he had the correct bank officer on the line and gave him the account number, which the officer called up on his computer. Then Popoff gave him the transaction code and ordered the funds transferred into another account. The officer didn't even express his disappointment that so much money was being removed. Well, the bank had plenty of deposits, didn't it? The Russian was now richer by over $5 million, but poorer in that the enemy might soon have his cover name and physical description. Popoff had to get out of the country. He took the exit to Heathrow and ended up at Terminal 4. 10 minutes later, having returned his rental car, he went in and got the last first-class ticket on a British Airways flight to Chicago. He had to hurry to catch the flight, but made it aboard, where a pretty stewardess conveyed him to his seat, and soon thereafter the 747 left the gate. "That was quite a mess," John Breitling observed, muting the TV in his office. Hereford would lead every TV newscast in the world. "They were unlucky," Henriksen replied. "But those commandos are pretty good, and if you give them a break, they'll use it. What the hell, 4 or 5 of them went down. Nobody's ever pulled that off against a force like this one." Breitling knew that Bill's heart was divided on the mission. He had to have at least some sympathy with the people he'd helped to attack. "Fallout?" "Well, if they got the leader alive, they're going to sweat him. But these IRA guys don't sing. I mean, they never sing. The only pipeline they could possibly have to us is Dimitri, and he's a pro. He's moving right now, probably on an airplane to somewhere, if I know him. He's got all sorts of false travel documents, credit cards, IDs. So he's probably safe. John, the KGB knew how to train its people, trust me." "If they should get him, would he talk?" Breitling asked. "Well, that's a risk." "Yes, he might well spill his guts," Henriksen had to admit. "If he gets back, I'll debrief him on the hazards involved." "Would it be a good idea to, well, eliminate him?" The question embarrassed his boss, Henriksen saw, as he prepared a careful and honest answer. "Strictly speaking, yes. But there are dangers in that, John. He's a pro. He probably has a mailbox somewhere." Seeing Breitling's confusion, he explained. "You guard against the possibility of being killed by writing everything down and putting it in a safe place. If you don't access the box every month or so, the information inside gets distributed according to a prearranged plan. You have a lawyer do that for you. That is a big risk to us, okay?"
"Dead or alive, he can burn us. And in this case, it's more dangerous if he's dead." Henriksen paused. "No, we want him alive. And under our control, John."
"Okay, you handle it, Bill." Breitling leaned back in his chair and closed his eyes. They were too close now to run unnecessary risks. Okay, the Russian would be handled, put under wraps. It might even save Popoff's life. Hell, he thought, it would save his life, wouldn't it?
He hoped that the Russian would be properly appreciative. Breitling had to be properly appreciative, too. This Rainbow Bunch was crippled now, or at least badly hurt. It had to be. Popoff had fulfilled 2 missions. He'd helped raise the world's consciousness about terrorism, and thus gotten Global Security its contract with the Sydney Olympics. And then he'd helped sting this new counter-terror bunch, hopefully enough to take them out of play. The operation was now fully in place and awaited only the right time for activation. So close, Breitling thought. It was probably normal to have the jitters at moments like this. Confidence was a thing of distance. The farther away you were, the easier it was to think yourself invincible. But then you got close and the dangers grew with their proximity. But that didn't change anything, did it? No, not really. The plan was perfect. They just had to execute it. Sean Grady came out of surgery at just after 8 in the evening, following 3.5 hours on the table. The orthopod who'd worked on him was first rate, Bellow saw. The humerus was fixed in place with a cobalt steel pin that would be permanent and large enough that in the unlikely event that Grady ever entered an international airport in the future, he'd probably set off the metal detector while stark naked. Luckily for him, the brachial plexus had not been damaged by the 2 bullets that had entered his body, and so he'd suffer no permanent loss of use of his arm. The secondary damage to his chest was minor. He'd recover fully, the British Army surgeon concluded, and so could enjoy full physical health during the lifelong prison term that surely awaited him. The surgery had been performed under full general anesthesia, of course, using nitrous oxide, just as in American hospitals, coupled with the lingering effects of the barbiturates that had been used to begin his sedation. Bellow sat by the bed in the hospital's recovery room, watching the bio-monitors and waiting for him to awaken. It would not be an event so much as a process, probably a lengthy one. There were police around now, both in uniform and out, watching with him. Clark and Chavez were there too, standing and staring at the man who'd so brazenly attacked their men. And their women, Bellow reminded himself. Chavez especially had eyes like flint. Hard, dark, and cold, though his face appeared placid enough. He thought he knew the senior Rainbow people pretty well. They were clearly professionals, and in the case of Clark and Chavez, people who'd lived in the black world and done some very black things, most of which he didn't and would never know about. But Bellow knew that both men were people of order, like police officers in many ways, keepers of the rules. Maybe they broke them sometimes, but it was only to sustain them. They were romantics, just as the terrorists were, but the difference was in their choice of cause. Their purpose was to protect. Grady's was to upset. And in the difference of mission was the difference between the men. It was that simple to them. Now, however angry they might feel at this sleeping man, they would not cause him physical harm. They'd leave his punishment to the society that Grady had so viciously attacked, and whose rules they were sworn to protect, if not always uphold. "Any time now," Bellow said. Grady's vital signs were all coming up. The body moved a little as his brain started to come back to wakefulness, just minor flexes here and there. It would find that some parts were not responding as they should, then focus on them to see what the limitations were, looking for pain, but not finding it yet. Now the head started turning, slowly, left and right, and soon the eyelids fluttered, also slowly. Bellow consulted the list of IDs that others had drawn up and hoped that the British police and the guys from 5 had provided him with good data. "Sean," he said. "Sean, are you awake?"
"Who?"
"It's me. It's Jimmy Carr, Sean. You back with us now, Sean?"
"Where? I..."
the voice croaked.
"University Hospital. Dublin, Sean. Dr. McCaskey just finished fixing your shoulder up. You're in the recovery room. You're going to be okay, Sean. But my God, getting you here was the devil's own work. Does it hurt, your shoulder, Sean?"
"No.
No hurt now, Jimmy. How many? How many of us? 10. 10 of us got away. They're off in the safe houses now, lad.
Good.
The eyes opened and saw someone wearing a surgical mask and cap, but he couldn't focus well, and the image was a blur. The room. Yes, it was a hospital. The ceiling, rectangular tiles held in a metal rack. The lighting, fluorescent. His throat was dry and a little sore from the intubation, but it didn't matter. He was living inside a dream, and none of this was actually happening. He was floating on a white, awkward cloud. But at least Jimmy Carr was here.
Roddy. Where's Roddy?
Roddy's dead, Sean, Bello answered. Sorry, but he didn't make it.
Oh, damn,
Grady breathed.
Not Roddy.
Sean, we need some information. We need it quickly.
What information?
The chap who got us the information, we need to contact him. But we don't know how to find him.
Josef, you mean?
Bingo, Paul Bello thought.
Yes, Sean. Josef, we need to get in touch with him. The money? I have that in my wallet, lad.
Oh, Clark thought, turning. Bill Tawney had all of Grady's personal possessions sitting on a portable table. In the wallet, he saw, were 210 British pounds, 170 Irish pounds, and several slips of paper. On one yellow post-it note were two numbers, six digits each, with no explanation. A Swiss or other numbered account? The spook wondered.
How do we access it, Sean? We need to do that at once, you see, my friend.
Swiss Commercial Bank in Bern. Call account number and control number in my wallet.
Good. Thank you, Sean.
And Josef.
What's the rest of his name? How do we get in touch with him, Sean?
Please, we need to do that right away, Sean.
Bello's false Irish accent wasn't good enough to pass muster with a drunk, but Grady's current condition was far beyond anything alcohol could do to the human mind.
Don't know. He contacts us, remember. Josef Andreevich contacts me through Robert, through the network. Never gave me a way to contact him.
His last name, Sean. What is it? You never told me.
Serov. Josef Andreevich Serov. Russian. KGB chap. Bekaa Valley. Years ago.
Well, he gave us good information on this rainbow mob, didn't he, Sean?
How many did we? How many?
10, Sean. We killed 10 of them. And we got away. But you were shot on the escape in your Jaguar, remember? But we hurt them, Sean. We hurt them badly.
Bello assured him.
Good. Good. Hurt them. Kill them. Kill them all,
Grady whispered from his gurney.
Not quite, asshole, Chavez observed quietly, from a few feet away.
Did we get the two women? Jimmy, did we get them?
Oh, yes, Sean. I shot them myself. Now, Sean, this Russian chap, I need to know more about him.
Josef? Good man, KGB. Got the money and the drugs for us. Lots of money. 6 million. 6. And the cocaine.
Grady added for the TV minicam that sat on a tripod next to the bed.
Got it for us at Shannon, remember? Flew in on the little jet. The money and the drugs from America. Well, think it was America. Must have been. The way he talks now. American accent like the television. Funny thing for a Russian, Jimmy.
Yosef Andreevich Serov?
The figure on the bed tried to nod.
That's how they do names, Jimmy. Joseph. Son of Andrew.
What does he look like, Sean?
Tall as me. Brown hair, eyes, round face, speaks many languages. Bekaa Valley, 1986. Good man, helped us a lot.
How are we doing, Bill? Clark whispered to Tawny.
Well, none of this can be used in court, but...
Fuck the courts, Bill. How good is this? Does it match with anything?
The name Serov doesn't ring a bell, but I can check with our files. We can run these numbers down, and there will be a paper trail of some sort, but...
He checked his watch.
It will have to wait until tomorrow.
Clark nodded. Hell of an interrogation method.
Never seen this before. Yes, it is.
Just then Grady's eyes opened more. He saw the others around the bed, and his face twisted into a question.
"Who are you?"
he asked groggily, finding a strange face in this dream.
"My name is Clark. John Clark, Sean."
The eyes went wide for a second.
"But you're..."
"That's right, pal. That's who I am. And thanks for spilling your guts. We got all of you, Sean. All 15 dead or captured. I hope you like it here in England, boy. You're going to be here a long, long time."
"Why don't you go back to sleep now, lad?" he asked with grossly overdone courtesy.
"I've killed better men than you, punk," he thought, behind a supposedly impassive mien that in fact proclaimed his feelings. Dr. Bellow pocketed his tape recorder and his notes. It rarely failed. The twilight state following general anesthesia made any mind vulnerable to suggestion. That was why people with high security clearances never went to the hospital without someone from their parent agencies nearby. In this case, he'd had 10 minutes or so to dive deep inside and come back out with information. It could never be used in a court of law, but then Rainbow wasn't composed of cops.
"Malloy got him, eh?" Clark asked on his way to the door.
"Actually, it was Sergeant Nance," Chavez answered.
"We have to get him something nice for this job," Rainbow Six observed. "We owe him for this. We got a name now, Domingo. A Russian name."
"Not a good one. It's got to be a cover name."
"Oh?"
"Yeah, John, don't you recognize it? Serov, former chairman of KGB, back in the 60s, I think, fired a long time ago because he screwed something up." Clark nodded. It wouldn't be the name on the guy's real passport, and that was too bad. But it was a name, and names could be tracked. They walked out of the hospital into the cool British evening. John's car was waiting, with Corporal Mole looking rather pleased with himself. He'd get a nice ribbon for the day's work, and probably a very nice letter from this American pseudo-general. John and Ding got in, and the car drove to the base stockade, where the others were being kept for the time being, because the local jail wasn't secure enough. Inside, they were guided to an interrogation room. Timothy O'Neill was waiting there, handcuffed to a chair.
"Hello," John said. "My name is Clark. This is Domingo Chavez."
The prisoner just stared at them.
"You were sent here to murder our wives," John went on. That didn't make him so much as blink either.
"But you fucked it all up. There were 15 of you. There are 6 now. The rest won't be doing much of anything. You know, people like you make me ashamed to be Irish. Jesus, kid, you're not even an effective criminal. By the way, Clark is just my working name. Before that, it was John Kelly, and my wife's maiden name was O'Toole. So, now you IRA pukes are killing Irish Catholic Americans, eh?"
It's not going to look good in the papers, punk. Not to mention selling coke, all that coke the Russian brought in, Chavez added.
Drugs.
We don't. Sure you do. Sean Grady just told us everything, sang like a fucking canary. We have the number of the Swiss bank account, and this Russian guy.
Sarov, Chavez added helpfully. Yosef Andreevich Sarov, Sean's old pal from the Bekaa Valley.
I have nothing to say.
Which was more than O'Neill had planned to say. Sean Grady talked? Sean? That was not possible. But where else could they have gotten that information? Was the world totally mad?
Mano, Ding continued, that was my wife you wanted to kill. And she's got my baby in her belly. You think you're going to be around much longer? John, this guy ever going to get out of prison?
Not any time soon, Domingo.
Well, Timmy, let me tell you something. Where I come from, you mess with a man's lady, there's a price that has to be paid. And it ain't no little price. And where I come from, you never, ever mess with a man's kids. The price for that's even worse, you little fuck.
Little fuck, Chavez wondered. No, I think we can fix that, John. I can fix him so he ain't never gonna fuck anything. From the scabbard on his belt, Ding extracted a marine-type K-bar fighting knife. The blade was black, except for the gleaming quarter-inch edge.
Not sure that's a good idea, Ding, Clark objected weakly.
Why not? Feels pretty good to me right now, man.
Chavez got out of his chair and walked up to O'Neill. Then he lowered his knife hand to the chair.
Ain't hard to do, man. Just flick, and we can start your sex change operation. I ain't a doc, you understand, but I know the first part of the procedure, you know?
Ding bent down to press his nose against O'Neill's.
Man, you don't ever, ever mess with a Latino's lady. Do you hear me?
Timothy O'Neill had had a bad enough day to this point. He looked in the eyes of this Spanish man, heard the accent, and knew that this was not an Englishman, not even an American of the type he thought he knew.
I've done this before, man. Mainly I kill with guns, but I've taken bastards down with a knife once or twice. It's funny how they squirm. But I ain't gonna kill you, boy. I'm just gonna make you a girl.
The knife moved tight up against the crotch of the man cuffed to the chair.
Back it off, Domingo, Clark ordered.
Fuck you, John. That's my wife he wanted to hurt, man. Well, I'm gonna fix this little fuck so he never hurts no more girls, Mano.
Chavez turned to look at the prisoner again.
I'm gonna watch your eyes when I cut it all off, Timmy. I want to see your face when you start to turn into a girl.
O'Neill blinked as he looked deep into the dark Spanish eyes. He saw the rage there, hot and passionate. But as bad as that was, so was the reason for it. He and his mates had planned to kidnap and maybe kill a pregnant woman. And there was shame in that. And for that reason there was justice in the fury before his face.
"It wasn't like that," O'Neill gasped. "We didn't have the chance to rape her, eh?" "Well, ain't that a big fucking deal," Chavez observed.
No, not rape, never. Nobody in the unit ever did that. We're not..."
"You're fucking scum, Timmy. But soon you're just gonna be scum, 'cause ain't no more fucking in your future."
The knife moved a little.
"This is gonna be fun, John. Like the guy we did in Libya 2 years ago, remember?"
"Jesus, Ding, I still have nightmares about that one," Clark acknowledged, looking away. "I'm telling you, Domingo, don't do it."
"Fuck you, John."
His free hand reached to loosen O'Neill's belt, then the button at the top of his slacks. Then he reached inside.
"Well, shit! Ain't much to cut off. Hardly any dick here at all."
"O'Neill, if you have anything to tell us, better say it now. I can't control this kid. I've seen him like this before, and..."
"Too much talk, John. Shit! Grady spilled his guts anyway. What does this one know that we need? I'm going to cut it all off and feed it to one of the guard dogs. They like fresh meat.
Domingo, we are civilized people, and we don't...
Civilized? My ass, John. He wanted to kill my wife and my baby.
O'Neill's eyes popped again.
No, no, we never intended to...
Sure, asshole, Chavez taunted. You had those fucking guns because you wanted to win their hearts and minds, right? Woman killer? Baby killer?
Chavez spat.
I didn't kill anybody. Didn't even fire my rifle.
Great. So you're incompetent. You think you deserve to have a dick just because you're fucking incompetent?
Who's this Russian guy? Clark asked.
Sean's friend. Sarov. Yosef Sarov. He got the money and the drugs.
Drugs? Christ, John. They're fucking druggies, too.
Where's the money? John persisted.
Swiss bank. Numbered account. Yosef set it up, $6 million, and Sean asked him to bring us 10 kilos of cocaine to sell for the money. We need the money to continue operations.
Where are the drugs, Tim? Clark demanded next.
Farmhouse.
O'Neill gave them a town and road description that went into Chavez's pocketed tape recorder. The Sarov guy, what's he look like? And he got that, too. Chavez backed off and let his visible temper subside. Then he smiled.
Okay, John, let's talk to the others.
Thanks, Timmy.
You can keep your dick, Mano.
It was late afternoon over Canada's Quebec province. The sun reflected off the hundreds of lakes, some of them still covered with ice. Popoff had been sleepless for the entire flight, the only wakeful passenger in first class. Again and again his mind went over the same data. If the British had captured Grady, then they had his primary cover name, which was in his travel documents. Well, he'd dispose of them that very day. They had a physical description, but he looked not the least bit remarkable. Grady had the number of the Swiss account that Dmitri had set up, but he'd already transferred the funds to another account, one not traceable to him. It was theoretically possible that the opposition could pursue the information Grady was sure to give them. Popoff had no illusions about that. Perhaps even secure a set of fingerprints from... No, that was too unlikely to be considered a danger, and no Western intelligence service would have anything to cross-match. No Western service even knew anything about him. If they had, he would have been arrested long before. So, what did that leave? A name that would soon evaporate, a description that fitted a million other men, and a bank account number for a defunct account. In short, very little. He did need to check out, though, very quickly, the procedures by which Swiss banks transferred funds, and whether that process was protected by the anonymity laws that protected the accounts themselves. Even that... The Swiss were not paragons of integrity, were they? No, there would be an arrangement between the banks and the police. There had to be. Even if the only purpose was to enable the Swiss police to lie effectively to other national police forces. But the second account was truly a shadow one. He'd set it up through an attorney who didn't have the ability to betray him, because they'd only met over the telephone. So there was no path from the information Grady had to where he was now, and that was good. He'd have to think very carefully about ever accessing the $5.7 million in the second account, but there might well be a way to do it. Through another attorney, perhaps, in Liechtenstein, where banking laws were even stricter than in Switzerland. He'd have to look into it. An American attorney could guide him in the necessary procedures, also under total anonymity. "You're safe, Dmitri Arkadyevich," Popov told himself. "Safe and rich." But it was time to stop taking risks. He'd initiate no more field operations for John Breitling. Once he got into O'Hare, he'd catch the next flight to New York, get back to his apartment, report into Breitling, and then look for an elegant escape route. Would Breitling let him go?
He'd have to, Popov told himself. He and Henriksen were the only men on the planet who could link the executive to mass murder. He might think about killing me, but Henriksen would warn him not to. Henriksen was also a professional, and he knew the rules of the game. Popov had kept a diary, which was in a safe place, the vault of a law firm in New York, with carefully written handling instructions. So no, that was not a real danger, so long as his friends knew the rules, and Popov would remind them, just in case. Why go back to New York at all? Why not simply disappear? It was tempting. But no. If nothing else, he had to tell Breitling and Henriksen to leave him alone from now on, and explain why it was in their interest to do so. Besides, Breitling had an unusually good source in the American government, and Popov could use that person's information as additional protection. You never had too much protection. With all that decided, Popov finally allowed himself to relax. Another 90 minutes to Chicago. Below him was a vast world with plenty of room to disappear in, and now he had the money for it. It had all been worth it. "Okay, what do we have?" John asked his senior executives.
"This name, Joseph Serov. It's not on our computer in London," said Cyril Holt of the Security Service. "What about CIA?"
Clark shook his head.
"We have two guys named Serov on the books. One's dead. The other one's in his late 60s and retired in Moscow."
"What about the description?"
"Well, it fits this chap."
Holt passed a photo across the table.
"I've seen this one before."
"He's the chap who met with Ivan Kirilenko in London some weeks ago. That fits the rest of the puzzle, John. We believe he was involved in the leak of information on your organization, as you will recall. For him, then, to show up with Grady, well, it does fit, almost too well, as a matter of fact."
"Any way to press this?"
"We can go to the RVS. Both we and CIA have relatively good relations with Sergei Golovko, and perhaps they can assist us. I will lobby very hard for that," Holt promised.
"What else?"
"These numbers," Bill Tawney put in. "One is probably a bank account identification number, and the other is probably the control activation code number. We'll have their police look into it for us. That will tell us something, if the money hasn't been laundered, of course, and if the account is still active, which it ought to be."
"The weapons," the senior cop present told them, "judging by the serial numbers, are of Soviet origin, from the factory in Kazan. They're fairly old, at least 10 years, but none of them had ever been fired before today. On the drug issue, I forwarded the information to Dennis McGuire. He's chief of the Garda. It will be on the telly in the morning. They found and seized 10 pounds of pure cocaine. By pure, I mean medicinal quality, almost as though it had been purchased from a pharmaceutical house. The street value is enormous. Millions," the chief superintendent told them. "It was found in a semi-abandoned farmhouse on the Irish west coast. We have identification on 3 of the 6 prisoners. One has not yet been able to talk to us because of his injuries. Oh, they were using cellular phones to communicate, like walkie-talkies. Your Noonan chap did very well indeed to close the phone cells down. God only knows how many lives that saved," Holt told them.
At the far end of the table, Chavez nodded and shivered at the news. If they'd been able to coordinate their actions, Jesus, it would not have been a good day for the good guys. What they'd had was bad enough. There would be funerals. People would have to put on their Class A uniforms and line up and fire off the guns. And then they'd have to replace the men who were gone. Not far away, Mike Chin was in a bed, a cast on one of his wounded legs because a bone was broken. Team 1 was out of business for at least a month, even as well as they'd fought back.
Noonan had come through big time, having killed three of them with his pistol, along with Franklin, who'd just about decapitated one with his big Macmillan 50, then used his monster rifle to kill the little brown truck and keep the five terrorists in it from getting away. Chavez was looking down at the conference table and shaking his head when his beeper went off. He lifted it and saw that it was his home number. He rose from his seat and called on the wall phone.
"Yeah, honey?"
"Ding, you want to come over here?"
"It started," Patsy told him calmly.
Ding's response was a sudden flip of his heart.
"On the way, baby."
Ding hung up.
"John, I gotta get home. Patsy says it started."
"Okay, Domingo." Clark managed a smile, finally. "Give her a kiss for me."
"Roger, Mr. C."
And Chavez headed for the door.
"The timing on this thing is never good, is it?" Tawny observed.
"Well, at least something good is happening today." John rubbed his eyes. He even accepted the idea of becoming a grandfather. It beat the hell out of losing people, a fact that had yet to hammer all the way into his consciousness. His people, two of them dead, several more wounded. His people.
"Okay," Clark went on. "What about the information leak? People, we've been set up and hit. What are we going to do about it?"
"Hello, Ed. It's Carol," the president's science advisor said.
"Hello, Dr. Breitling. What can I do for you?"
"What the hell happened in England today? Was it our people? Our rainbow team, I mean?"
"Yes, Carol, it was."
"How did they do? The TV wasn't very clear, and..."
"Two dead, four or so wounded," the DCI answered. "Nine terrorists dead, six captured, including their leader."
"The radios we got to them, how'd they work?"
"Not sure. I haven't seen the after-action report yet, but I know the main thing they're going to want to know."
"What's that, Ed?"
"Who spilled the beans?" "They knew John's name, his wife and daughter's names, identities, and place of work. They had good intel, and John isn't very happy about that."
"The family members, are they okay?"
"Yeah, no civilians hurt, thank God."
"Hell, Carol, I know Sandy and Patricia. There's going to be some serious fallout over this one."
"Anything I can do to help?"
"Not sure yet. But I won't forget you asked."
"Yeah, well, I want to know if those radio gadgets worked. I told the guys at E-Systems to get them out pronto, 'cause these guys are important. Gee, I hope they helped some."
"I'll find out, Carol," the DCI promised.
"Okay, you know where to reach me."
"Okay, thanks for the call."
Chapter 30 Vistas. It was everything he'd expected, not knowing what to expect, and more. And at the end of it, Domingo Chavez held his son in his hands.
"Well," he said, looking down at the new life that would be his to guard, educate, and in time present to the world. After a second that seemed to last into weeks, he handed the newborn to his wife. Patsy's face was bathed in perspiration, and weary from the five-hour ordeal of delivery, but already, as such things went, the pain was forgotten. The goal had been achieved, and she held her child. The package was pink, hairless, and noisy, the last part assuaged by the proximity of Patsy's left breast, as John Connor Chavez got his first meal. But Patsy was exhausted, and in due course a nurse removed the child to the nursery. Then Ding kissed his wife and walked alongside her bed as she was wheeled to her room. She was already asleep when they arrived. He kissed her one last time and walked outside. His car took him back under the Hereford base, and then to the official home of Rainbow Six.
"Yeah?" John said, opening the door.
Chavez just handed over a cigar with a blue ring.
"John Connor Chavez,
7 pounds, 11 ounces. Patsy's doing fine, Grandpop, Ding said, with a subdued grin. After all, Patsy had done the hard part. There are moments to make the strongest of men weep, and this was one of them. The two men embraced. Well, John said after a minute or so, reaching into the pocket of his bathrobe for a handkerchief with which he rubbed his eyes. Who's he look like? Winston Churchill, Domingo replied with a laugh. Hell, John, I've never been able to figure that one out, but John Connor Chavez is a confusing enough name, isn't it? The little bastard has a lot of heritage behind him. I'll start him off on karate and guns about age 5. Maybe 6, Ding mused. Better golf and baseball, but he's your kid, Domingo. Come on in. Well? Sandy demanded. And Chavez gave the news for the second time while his boss lit up his Cuban cigar. He despised smoking, and Sandy, a nurse, hardly approved of the vice. But on this one occasion, both relented. Mrs. Clark gave Ding a hug.
John Connor?
You knew? John Terence Clark asked. Sandy nodded.
Patsy told me last week.
It was supposed to be a secret, the new father objected.
I'm her mother, Ding, Sandy explained.
Breakfast? The men checked their watches. It was just after 4 in the morning, close enough, they all agreed.
You know, John, this is pretty profound, Chavez said.
His father-in-law noted how Domingo switched in and out of accents, depending on the nature of the conversation. The previous day, interrogating the PIRA prisoners, he'd been pure Los Angeles gang kid, his speech redolent with Spanish accent and street euphemisms. But in his reflective moments, he reverted to a man with a university master's degree with no accent at all.
I'm a papa. I've got a son.
Followed by a slow, satisfied, and somewhat awestruck grin.
Wow.
The great adventure, Domingo, John agreed, while his wife got the bacon going. He poured the coffee.
Huh?
Building a complete person. That's the great adventure, sonny boy, and if you don't do it right, what the hell good are you?
Well, you guys have done okay.
Thanks, Domingo, Sandy said from the stove. We worked at it pretty hard. More her than me, John said. I was away so damn much playing field spook. Missed 3 Christmases, goddammit. You never forgive yourself for that, he explained. That's the magic morning, and you're supposed to be there.
Doing what?
Russia twice. Iran once. Getting assets out every time. 2 worked, but 1 came apart on me. Lost that one, and he didn't make it. Russians have never been real forgiving on state treason. He bit the big one 4 months later, poor bastard. Not a good Christmas, Clark concluded, remembering just how bleak that had been, seeing the KGB scoop the man up not 50 meters from where he'd been standing, seeing the face turned to him, the look of despair on the doomed face, having to turn away to make his own escape down the pipeline he'd set up for 2, knowing there was nothing else he might have done, but feeling like shit about it anyway. Then, finally, he'd had to explain to Ed Foley what had happened, only to learn later that the agent had been burned, shopped was the euphemism, by a KGB mole inside CIA's own headquarters building. And that fuck was still alive in a federal prison, with cable TV and central heating.
It's history, John, Chavez told him, understanding the look.
They'd deployed on similar missions, but the Clark-Chavez team had never failed, though some of their missions had been on the insane side of Harry.
You know the funny part about this?
What's that? John asked, wondering if it would be the same feeling he'd had.
I know I'm going to die now. Someday, I mean. The little guy, he's got to outlive me.
If he doesn't, then I've screwed it up.
Can't let that happen, can I?
JC is my responsibility.